Hello, everyone, and Happy New Year. Hope you had a great New Year's celebration. Hope that 2022 is going to be better. It was actually a very good year for me in strange ways, but I'm hoping that, and I know it was a tough year for a lot of you out there, and let's hope that 2022 will be a better year for all. Stay healthy, stay safe as we move forward. And anyway, I do appreciate all the listeners to the show. And as I mentioned before in a number of shows, there's new listeners contacting me all the time. I just had someone contact me a couple of days ago that wanted to know all my favorite YouTube videos. That's a tough one, just to let you know, because I started looking through. It takes some time because there is a lot of YouTube that you want to skip over. There's a lot of things on there. People are looking to get high ratings. You know, there are certain channels you want to stay away from. I don't want to start out on a bad note here, but there are certain channels you want to stay away from. And anyway, maybe I'll get into that at some point later on. But again, thanks everyone for staying tuned all these years. Our blog this week from Charles Lear is a UFO lab in Japan. This is something that opened up on June 24th of this year, World UFO Day in Japan. And he's writing that. And we do it. He does an audio blog, not we do. He does an audio blog every week too. And I can't wait to hear how he handles Japanese when it comes to this audio blog. That should be pretty interesting, to say the least. We have a great guest tonight. Really enjoy every time I talk to him. It's a lot of fun. He's got quite a background, and you know, he probably gets tired of talking about his father, but we're going to talk about his father anyway. And that's the great J. Allen Hynek. Paul Hynek is our guest, and we're going to be talking about that. But Paul has had quite a career on his own, and he's been involved in all kinds of things. His bio's up in the show notes, so check that out. And without further ado, welcome to the show, Paul.
Hello, Martin. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. Always, always fun talking to you every time. I always have a lot of fun. And you have a great sense of humor. Now, when you were growing up in the household, did your dad have that type of sense of humor?
Oh, yeah. You know, people tend to think of scientists, and I'm talking to you, Project Blue Book friends, as sort of, you know, Vulcan type logic dominated robots. And our father, you know, I'm one of five children, as you know, because you've met my brother Joel.
Yes.
He had a very overdeveloped fondness for puns. May I tell you the triple pun, Martin?
I'd love to hear it.
Yes. Delve to the bottom of the bowels of Pun Mountain. Okay, so the triple pun was long thought impossible by the best minds in punnery. And the triple pun means three words, three consecutive words, three puns. Okay. So my father, undeterred by the daunting Sisyphean challenge of this, decided to crack the code to untie the Gordian knot. And he did. And he came back bringing the elixir to the village of the triple pun. And it goes like this. And the setup is not contrived or awkward at all. So there's an astronomer father, naturally, who has a cattle farm. Again, not at all contrived, Martin. And he says he'll give the cattle farm that he has. He's a gentleman, you know, side hustle hobbyist cattle farmer, to his sons with the one condition that they call the farm Solar Focus. Okay. Again, not at all awkward, perfectly natural story that you don't even know is the premise for a pun. And his sons say, okay, astronomer father, thanks. And why do you require that we name the cattle farm from you Solar Focus? And the father responds, you have to name it Solar Focus because that's where the, and are you ready? I hope you're all sitting down. The sun's SONSSUNS, Rays, RAYS, RAISE, Meet, MEAT, MEET. Solar Focus, Suns, Rays, Meet.
Oh my God, how long did that take?
Oh, he would draw that out. And you know, the thing is, my mom had a rule at the dinner table. If you told three puns, you had to leave. And there was no appeal process. You were gone. You were banished. And so, like, if I was up to two, I would whisper to my brother and he would tell the third one. But my dad came up with a triple pun because one night he had to leave to go do work. But it was impolitic to say that. So he busted out the triple pun and he was banished. And I saw him smirking on the way out.
I hope he got a snack.
I'm sure. He had the attic away from all of us bratty kids. I'm sure he had it well provisioned.
Oh, wow. I spoke with Pam. I'm just trying to think her last name. Pam, she was the widow of Tom Schneider, the talk show host.
Oh, sure.
And yes. And she told me that Tom's favorite guest, one of his very, very favorite guests was J. Allen Hynek.
He said, on the Tomorrow Show. Cool.
He said that she said that Pam Burke, that's her name. She said that after the show was over, she would ask him to stay. I mean, he would ask your dad to stay so they could chat. And that she said, I don't know of any other, I can't tell you of a handful of other people that had that honor. So,
oh, that's cool. I'd love to talk to her sometime. That'd be kind of fun.
Oh, I could do that. Yeah, I could certainly set that up. She's a very nice lady. So this is it's always fun. I think we're getting a little bit of feedback from your computer. I don't know if you can turn down your speakers just a little bit.
Yeah,
it's your speakers, not your mic.
Okay. All right. How's that?
So far, sounds pretty good. Okay. So let's talk about what you know. Your dad. I think when I very first started looking into this topic, one of the things that really fascinated me was when I started reading about your dad and how he, you know, he was like on one side, Project Blue Book. And then after a while, there was so much material that he said, now, wait a minute, there really is something to this UFO thing, UFO problem, as they often say. So Do you happen as a young kid, I guess you were pretty young when that transition happened. Do you remember any of that, his way of thinking back then?
You know, there are five children, as I mentioned, and there are kind of two generations. There's Scott, Roxanne, and Joel. Then there's a 12-year gap, and then there's me and my younger brother, Ross.
I see.
So we have, Ross and I have different recollections than the older generation. They remember Project Blue Book and the Air Force and, you know, my father getting involved and being trepidatious and my parents wondering about how, you know, working on the UFO problem, as you termed it, would affect tenure. He was at that point an untenured professor and, you know, jaunting around the country working on flying saucers, as it was known back then, was not really a helpful way to get tenure. So they remember that and, you know, the Air Force. What Ross and I remember more is the 70s and Close Encounters. And, you know, after he had already made that conversion, not from a skeptic to a believer, I don't think scientists really traffic with the word belief, but more as in somebody who accepted the accumulated weight of the data. So he was already, you know, bathing in the Kool-Aid by that point. But to your point, you know, I've talked a lot with our dear family friend, Jacques Vallée, and he says that it was the Socorro case in 1964 with Lonnie Zamora that really gave my father the comfort level to talk about abduction cases. I think he had long come to the conclusion that the UFO phenomena, which doesn't necessarily mean extraterrestrial origin, but that there is a phenomena was real, and it took him a while to sort of be comfortable as a nuts and bolts astrophysicist with the idea of abduction cases. And Lonnie Zamora wasn't technically an abduction case, but a a physical creature presence.
Right. Right. And that is taking another step, you know, that a lot of people do not want to take. And I really think also, you know, I say on the show all the time, I don't know what they are, you know, for the new listener. I've been doing this show in particular over 10 years, and I really don't have a clue to what these things are. But, you know, I have talked to many people that have seen beings, and, you know, they're something. I don't think that these people are making things up, you know, especially when it comes to like the Ariel School incident. Albert Wayne, that video I posted just a little while ago has about 8,000 views so far. And it was about his sighting and, you know, very earnest people. And he happened to look up to these amber colored windows and he saw, you know, humanoid type creatures staring down at him, you know, but there's so many people. There was another girl I interviewed, very similar situation, you know, and it does seem like taking a big leap. But there's a lot of times you got to figure whatever those craft are, there's something piloting them, whether they're, you know, drone remote or whether they're right there.
Right. And I think I break down the world into two kinds of people. And I don't know if this quote came from Richard Feynman or well before him, but basically there are two kinds of people in the world. Those who are comfortable with questions they can't answer, and those who prefer answers they don't question. Mm-hmm. And the UFO field, if you're okay not having the answers, I think you're more comfortable taking that next step, because it's difficult for some people to say, okay, there's a phenomenon here, and not have a ready-made answer like extraterrestrial to provide the answers for it. It's because it's very difficult. And like you said, you've been doing this for 10 years. I don't remember life without UFOs. We had flying saucer ornaments on the Christmas trees. I'm not really that much closer, although I do have a particular area of interest for origin. But if you're not comfortable having a large question that you can't answer, I don't think you really want to take that next step. I think you would just keep saying, oh, I hear about these UFOs, but, you know, I got to pay my mortgage. I got to do this. I'm not interested. I don't know. But if you're a little bit more comfortable with ambiguity, I think that naturally propels you a little bit more to add one more, you know, unanswered question to your quiver.
Yes. So, you know, you're not going to get away with me not asking you what you said you have kind of an opinion of origin. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. I'd like to know what that opinion is. And I know it's just an opinion.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's not going to be news to you. But so given a variety of factors, well, first, you know, I think I'm not a scientist, but I can pretend to be one sometimes. Scientists often work with the process of elimination. So you start with sort of the knee-jerk cultural default idea of extraterrestrial origin. Well, what are the problems with that? And there's a variety of non-trivial problems with that hypothesis. One is that the vast distances mm-hmm. that they have to go through, and you kind of alluded to this, whether there might be drones or synthetic beings or biological beings, etc. But in any case, they have to come from a very long way away. If they're doing it through conventional propulsion or, you know, wormholes or something else, don't know, but they come from a long way away. And first of all, how do they even find us? Yes, we've been beaming episodes of I Love Lucy into the universe low these many decades, but it's non-trivial just to find us in the vastness of space. And then if they come from so far away by whatever means they do, why do they come here and float in the sky or scare Farmer Jones at night and leave? Why not the signal, you know, White House landing with Walter Cronkite narrating it? We also have very sensitive instruments to detect their entrance or objects entering and leaving the atmosphere. And we don't seem to have associated reports of that. Although I have a fun anecdote about that, if you like. And then they exhibit a lot of comfort in our gravity and our atmosphere. So those are interesting things you have to consider if you want the extraterrestrial hypothesis. But even beyond that, my father and Jacques and others long ago started thinking that the extraterrestrial hypothesis could well be part of the phenomena, but doesn't seem to explain the totality of the phenomena. I think that's one of the reasons my father called his first book The UFO Experience, as opposed to The UFO Sighting, or, you know, just focusing on the object. Because, as you know, a lot of experiencers, contactees, witnesses, what have you, don't often place the visual sighting of a craft as the sort of the largest element of the overall experience. So there seems to be more to it. So many before me have thought, well, there may be an interdimensional aspect. And there are some interesting reasons for that. For me, that explains the two biggest questions of how would they know about us? Well, they're, you know, in LA, we say you're somewhere adjacent. They're Earth adjacent, right? They're maybe our cousins or maybe our future selves. So that would help explain how they know about us and why they care. So to me, that's a really intriguing path. And I was having lunch with a friend of mine who, by the way, crash landed tardigrades on the moon a couple of years ago. And he knew about my father and asked me, where does your father think UFOs come from? I said, oh, I don't know, maybe interdimensional. He said, oh, you should read a book called Alien Information Theory. And I said, Alien Information Theory, sexiest book title ever. So of course I read that. And, you know, it posits the theory that when you take DMT, which is the most powerful psychedelic drug known on Earth, sort of the big brother of its better known little sister, ayahuasca, that the experiences you have there may not be hallucinations, but they may actually be different realities that DMT allows you to sort of filter and receive while doing that. And so I read that book, and I read The Spirit Molecule by Rick Strassman. And I was struck, Martin, by what seemed to me to be the similarities between the data he was collecting and the patterns from the early days of ufology. I thought, well, that's interesting. So purely in the interest of science, Martin, I started taking DMT. And the first time I took it, like many others, I felt transported through a vividly colored tunnel to this other realm. And it was overwhelming and amazing. And by the time I got my sea legs, and I then sort of communicated to the Gaia-like, mostly feminine intelligence all around me, are you what we perceive to be UFOs and aliens? And I felt, you know, millions of miles of synapses and neurons firing as I felt the fabric of the universe being created. And the answer bubbled down to me, we can't explain in a way that you would understand.
Well, I believe that. I totally believe that.
And I thought, well, I understand no. So it seems like there's something here. It was like a preliminary confirmation. And I'm now actually working on a way with both DMT users and UFO experiencers to try to verify that those experiences might actually be real.
How about that? You know, the way this whole show went together, behind the scenes, the person that doesn't know what happened, you got pulled in just before the show, because with this streaming platform that I'm using, for some reason the links have been wrong a couple of different shows. Mm-hmm. As long as yours, you were waiting for me and I'm waiting for you. But I'm kind of putting you on the spot, but you can bow out very easily. I've been watching. You are a historic person in a way. I'm talking about the youth thing that have been tested as the only person that's ever regressed in age. Do I have that correct, or is it the mind? What's the part of that?
My mind has not stayed youthful. My mind has deteriorated. But I would nuance that to say I can make the claim that I'm not the only person, but in the history of the world, based on evidence published in a scientific journal, I have the most success in reversing my age.
That's what I'm trying to say. And I do another show called The Everything Else Show. I would love to do a show just entirely on that. And you don't have to say anything. Oh, you already said sure. Okay. I'll be talking to you about that.
I'm free that day. I checked my schedule.
I think that is totally fascinating. You know, this show will talk about UFOs, but for those of you that just heard that whole thing, I'm going to do an entire show on this because there's a lot to say about it, and it's fascinating. Mm-hmm. And it's
a viable way for everybody to actually reverse their age in a medically documented fashion.
It's crazy. It's really amazing. Really amazing. All right. So we're going to go back to UFOs for now.
back to safer ground.
No, not necessarily. But so I know that I talked with you and Calvin Parker together. That was great. Yeah. And you were actually took his phone call and wrote it on the chalkboard at home. So I think that's back in 1973. Is that what?
Yeah, right.
Let's talk about what was it like? Just paint a picture of a day in the life of your youth growing up. And what was it like being in that household? I'm talking about UFOs, you know, for the most part, but.
So, you know, unless there's some reason for you at a very young age to compare your circumstances, either really good or really bad, to others, I think for most people, however you're raised seems normal. That's the default and the normal for you. So
yes,
growing up, I don't think any of us felt that it was that much different. You know, most of our life was pretty similar. I remember I talked about playing kickball when you and I and Calvin talked. And so we had a lot of things that were quite normal. But then we would have, you know, phone calls from Calvin Parker and our father Gil or Travis Walton over for dinner. And our dinner time conversations would be, you know, how we did at school, what's going on, and what exactly did you see at 6 p.m. last night to our dinner guest? So it was a mix of normal suburban Americana and overall scientific discussions, because my father was an astronomer. He was a scientist, and his later in life side hustle was UFO. So he didn't self-identify as a UFO guy, but more as a scientist. And I think he wanted to impart upon us kids the sort of wonder and magic of science and that way of looking at the world, accented often by UFOs.
Amazing. Amazing. And I'm sure you had some quite astounding dinner guests over the years. What was that like? I mean, did people come to visit with your dad? And
all sorts of people. And one series of meals that I can recount that even at the time I realized was super cool was in 1973, there was an eclipse cruise that left from New York that went to go see the point of totality off the western coast of Africa by the Canary Islands. And so our family, Ross and me and my mom and dad, went on there, and we went for free because my father was lecturing. And the really cool thing was that for those 2 weeks, our family and one other family shared one table for all our meals, and that was Neil Armstrong and his family.
Wow.
And this is 4 years after the moon launch, Martin. I mean, there's nobody in the world that, persnickety astronomer kid would rather have met than Neil Armstrong.
I bet.
And, you know, there's a story that came out in the Sun in the UK about 2 years ago, and you can search for it, just search like Heineken Armstrong, that it was Neil Armstrong who requested to sit with our family. Wow. Now, yeah. At the time, I thought maybe he was a fan of my father's prior astronomical exploits, but no, he was very interested in UFOs and almost joined with my father to do some public efforts. But, you know, he was more of a private person. And also, especially in the 70s, there was much more sort of stigma about UFOs and he wasn't comfortable. But behind the scenes, he was fascinated by UFOs. So for wow. us as kids, you know, meeting his kids, being friends with them and being with Neil Armstrong for 2 weeks was just a dream. And Neil deGrasse Tyson was a kid on the ship. Isaac Asimov was on the ship. And I remember two girls, maybe 20 years old, asking for his autograph. He wrote on their thighs, "Isaac Asimov was here." And I thought that was the best thing I'd ever seen in my life.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. And as far as other astronomers, did you ever meet Carl Sagan for one?
I didn't. I don't know about my other siblings, but, you know, I mentioned an anecdote related to detecting objects entering the atmosphere, and I could bring up Carl Sagan in relation to that. So, as you know, my father and Carl Sagan were kind of, I'd say, friendly, respectful foes. They had some debates on television. And actually, one day, I think what was on the Tonight Show, before they went on stage, Carl Sagan actually admitted that privately he had a somewhat different opinion than his kind of public poo-pooing. But as I learned from Jacques Vallée just a couple weeks ago, my father was talking with Carl Sagan about, well, shouldn't NORAD, and I don't remember what it stands for, but it's like the American, I think, installation in Wyoming, maybe Colorado, that has the responsibility of you know, checking for missiles coming in the atmosphere, et cetera, they should have reports. And so Carl Sagan said, well, Alan, I know somebody there. I'll go there. So he went there and he talked with them. And he asked them, hey, do you guys have reports of, I don't know if he used unidentified because that's kind of a charged term for the military, of objects entering the atmosphere that you don't know about. And apparently the people he talked to said, yes, we call those uncorrelated targets.
Huh.
And we dismiss them. We discard them because they're not part of our mission prerogative or our mission purview. And, you know, I'm not sure how much my father and Carl Sagan thought that was deliberate to tamp down. But to me, I think it's equally possible that this is a innocuous government agency discarding what could be really important UFO information because it's not their job, right? They've got a lot to do. They've got to correlate these targets and do whatever procedures they have. And so they're looking for a quick, no, it's like if you're interviewing 100 people for a job, you want to rule out people right away. So I think, you know, people think that the government is one big monolithic block that has orders from on high to rule out UFOs. I think it's much more multivariate and much more complicated and not always as sinister. And it's just, I think in this case, that's not their job. So they don't keep those records. And I found that fascinating.
You know, I was just on a shout out to Lou over at the Unidentified Celebrity Review. I was on his show last night on his live stream. A lot of fun. And that was one of the questions that I was actually throwing out there was, is, you know, when the government's looking into these, you know, into the UFOs as they should be coming up, really looking into it, wouldn't they contact, I mean, NORAD is one place, but there's also a lot of satellites that should be able to detect something coming in toward our orbit. Mm-hmm. And it just seems like that would be a logical place for them to look. Like, are there things coming in? And but like you said, you have an interesting theory, and it does. It's one of the things that I don't discount, that possibly some of whatever it is that comes here is either already here or coming in from another dimension, or it's all, you know, we don't know. But I really do like the thought that it's probably a lot of different things. And also I like what you said, that it's probably something we wouldn't understand. I think that's probably pretty accurate for some of it anyway.
Yeah, you know, NASA, on sort of a more prosaic level, has talked about one of the challenges in recognizing life elsewhere in the universe. And one of the, you know, things they have to consider is that we may not even recognize it as life as we know it. It could be such a, you know, not only not carbon-based, but it could be such a different format of life that we wouldn't even recognize it.
Right. It could be silicone-based too. That's another one. Or
methane-based, as some have surmised, right?
Right. But, you know, I mean, there is a lot to be said for the bipedal, bifocal. You know, I mean, you look at all the species on this planet, there's so many that have that trait. But, you know, this is also a conversation I got into last night was, you know, gravity. If there's a binary solar system, that could change evolution. A tidal moon, that could change evolution. There's so many variables, oxygen levels or whatever it is, the level they need to survive, all of those things, food, you know, things that make things that in our development developed our brains more, mm-hmm. like, you know, fire for cooking food, you know, right. that's another thing. So there's all these variables. It would be kind of shocking if a humanoid looked just like us, you know, a thousand light years away, but it's also possible too, you know, it's,
you know, I came across something recently in our early development. Our ancestors at one time were coexisting with two other hominoid species. And one of the other species was bigger, stronger, and smarter than us. Hmm. And yet we survived and they didn't. And it was fascinating. And what they sort of theorized is that those bigger, smarter, stronger entities had their pick of the litter. They could eat whatever they want. And we were kind of like hyenas coming in for seconds on the food and eating whatever we could and foraging and just basically just barely scraping by. And that at some point there was an environmental change and that led everybody to have to move and to have different diets. Well, these, you know, big, strong things that had been used to eating whatever they wanted, they were less able to adapt quickly to a different diet. Now, us being foragers and scrappers ate whatever we wanted. So it was our slightly higher ability to adapt to a different diet and different environment that led us to proliferate after that environmental change. Otherwise, you know, it could have been very different. And that's just such a razor thin margin for evolution.
Right. And, you know, like right now, if our power grid was completely gone, you know, I mean, it's a real high number of our population would be wiped out. But think of those who survive, are the people that are barely surviving now, you know, that grow their own food, that, mm-hmm. you know, those may be the ones that end up surviving, not to say that they have lesser intelligence. I'm just saying, you know, we're kind of we've had it kind of easy, and it would be awful hard to go back without power or anything like that. I mean, the average meal comes from something like 1500 miles away. You know, we would have a real tough time if everything went down.
Well, I mean, I'd be fine, Martin. I'd last a good 12 hours. Then my laptop dies and then it's just chaos.
After that, it's chaos. Yeah. Yeah. So as far as I want to get back just a little before we go into other things. So your idea is that possibly that these things could be interdimensional, possibly. I mean, that is really a really good theory. Mm-hmm. But then there's also the really strange things that, you know, there's never a sound barrier broken when these things speed off. They go into water and out of water and through water really fast. I mean, all these really strange things, and I don't know how another dimension would make that any, you know, coming from and going to, if that's all part of it, Had your father ever looked or talked about anything that you're aware of when it came to things like being seen on radar at high speeds and no sound barrier broken, things like that?
I don't remember specifically sound barriers, but he had something he talked about, the Cheshire Cat phenomena, where you'd see an object here, and then without seeing it move, you'd see it over here. So one of the examples of violating, you know, our known laws of physics, and there's several of those that he remarked that led him again to think this nuts and bolts thing of crafts coming here just doesn't seem to wash. The interdimensional hypothesis seems to me to explain some of the questions, but I'm not convinced that even if that is real, that it explains everything. Like you said, I think there could be multiple explanations. It could be extraterrestrial. It could be manifestations of collective unconscious. And we're talking about the good reports, right? The reports that bear scrutiny, not the hoaxes and misidentifications of Venus, et cetera. But I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, even if we find out that there is an extraterrestrial component, we still are peeling back onion layers for decades after that.
Right. Right. You know, and I also like what you said about, you know, the vast distances. I mean, it's even hard to fathom, you know, how far away a light year is. And the nearest star is over four light years away. How the travel could be possible. Maybe there's, you know, like you said, maybe there's a wormhole travel. Maybe there's something that they know about physics that we haven't figured out yet. Mm-hmm. You know, there's all kinds of things like that. But I've said this, you know, a number of times on the show, why would we be so special if there's life everywhere? You know, but I've had people that had pretty good answers for that too, you know, when it comes, you know, because, you know, our planet is thriving with life, you know, and the signals are out there that we're here. Not just, I'm talking about biological signals. Here's a question, and I think it's a decent one. So if you want to ask a question in chat, just put it in all caps like Joni did. During Blue Book was 1965, the Kecksburg crash. Do you know if that was investigated by Blue Book, your father?
I believe so, but I don't have any more information about it. I'm familiar with the case, but I don't know like the official Blue Book or my father's sort of determination about it.
Yeah. Yeah, there's controversy about Kecksburg, you know, whether it possibly could have been, you know, something that we put up there that came down. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's kind of bizarre how it did shoot off in another direction, or it changed directions or something on the path. That's always an interesting one. So, again, if you want to ask questions, just to let everyone know that we're going to a break at the top of the hour. And we're going to be taking calls, the last half hour screen calls with Bill's going to be screening your calls. So if you have a question, you can either put it in chat or save it for a call later on. What are some of the cases that you heard about at the supper table talk that was really fascinating?
Let's go back to Calvin Parker in Pascagoula. And that's a case that you know quite well, has sort of gotten even stronger over the passing years with more witnesses coming to the fore, attesting to what they saw in a consistent way with Calvin and Charlie's account.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the things I learned about in our interview that we did with you was that, you know, they saw they had the sighting, I think maybe on a Friday, and over the weekend, and they were in the personnel office of the shipyard at like 7 o'clock the next morning, which I thought was remarkable. And Calvin said that my father was in the office there at like 7 a.m. the next morning.
Amazing.
And he never understood how he was there that quickly. I think he must have been in the Gulf Coast already on some other kind of business. And, you know, he liked that case. And again, as you know, one of the interesting things about the case was that Calvin and Charlie were in the police room being, you know, interrogated, actually. And the police left the room and inadvertently left the tape recorder recording. And it's pretty clear that Charlie and Calvin, who were not, you know, trained actors, didn't know that was happening.
Right.
And it was left recording them. And what really seemed to be traumatized, honest, you know, trying to cope with the situation. And my father found that very compelling. Somebody asked him once, is that a good case? He said, yeah, that's a very strong case. They said, is it real? But my father, being a scientist and no, you know, besmirching meant to my friend Calvin, said, how the hell should I know? I wasn't there. But I believe that Calvin believes it happened, and there's good evidence to support that. That's what a scientist will say.
Yes.
And that case is just very strong. And it's one of many where, you know, you talked about how people don't want to believe accounts. You're at some point, you either have to embrace that, you know, unanswerable question that I mentioned, or just keep denying the accounts of increasingly of a larger and larger number of witnesses, some of them very credible by any way that you measure it. You know, my father would say that it got very awkward for the Air Force to deny accounts of Air Force pilots who they themselves had trained.
Ah.
And now we've got, you know, remarkably more open public posture on the part of the Navy and the Pentagon, thanks in part to Chris Mellon and Lou Elizondo, saying, hey, yes, they don't call them UFOs, they call them UAPs. They exist. They're out there. We're studying them. We're concerned for the safety of our aviators, and they may pose a risk to national security. So here you have the official organs and knowledgeable departments of the U.S. government saying, yeah, they're real, published now in the paper of record, the New York Times. So it's really hard to deny them in general. And then you have, when you dig into cases like Pascagoula or Lonnie Zamora in Socorro or Father Gill in Papua New Guinea and many other cases, yes, Gerald, my father did believe Father Gill's sighting, and Father Gill came to dinner. And
I remember you saying that. Yeah.
Yeah. And one of the things that struck me was, here was a guy who was very intelligent. He was an Anglican priest in Papua New Guinea who had an amazing sighting where they're waving to the, you know, reportedly waving to the creatures who waved back. And Father Gill was very intelligent. He, you know, he came to Chicago where we lived for an ecumenical religious conference, not to sell a UFO book. But he came to dinner at our house, and he didn't sort of launch into his account. But if you're a fairly well-known UFO witness and you come to dinner at the Hynek house, that's kind of the quid pro quo, right? So, and I found him to be very intelligent, very comfortable in his skin, nothing to gain by reporting this. It didn't help him in his, you know, in his priestly career. And just very consistent over the years, which is something that struck my father. My father would ask people questions from slightly different points of view to see if he could find like some daylight between their varying accounts. But he found him to be remarkably consistent and thought that was a wonderful case that had multiple witnesses.
Right, right. And I have heard someone talk about a similar case where they had this flashlight and they made the signal up and down like that, and the thing made a reaction up and down, just like the Father Gill case. And then the person was doing this, and the thing made a reaction like that. And then all of a sudden he put his flashlight down and he started thinking up and down, and the thing went up and down.
Wow, that's like three layers of super cool UFO remote control. Flashlight, hand, mind.
Yeah. So, what the point was that he was saying that it was had nothing to do with him moving the flashlight, had to do with his thoughts of moving the flashlight. So,
right. I think at first for him, it was probably far out enough that seems to be a correlation between a tool that he has and some object in the sky, and took him a little bit to realize that the tool was incidental.
Right. Right. And for those of you who have not looked into the Father Gill case, there's a great video of him talking about the whole case on YouTube. And that is one that I find, you know, very, very good.
I've not seen that. I would love to see that.
Oh, I'll make a note. Please, over there, Secretary, can you please make a note of that? Yes. My secretary's on top of that. So Allagash is another one. I love that case. I don't know how much you know about that case in particular, but that was in the 70s. Did your father happen to look into that and, you know, post Blue Book?
You know, I'm not familiar with that case, so I don't know. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Okay. It's up in Maine, and it was four guys, art students, and quite a very convincing encounter that they didn't remember till years later. They all forgot.
Do you know where in Maine that was? Because I was just in Maine last week.
Oh, you should have come visit me. That's where I live.
Yeah, so I was in Bethel for 2 days in western Maine.
Oh, so that's ski country up there.
Yeah, right.
Sunday River, all that. Yeah.
Right, exactly. Right.
Oh, anyway, it's up further. It's in the middle of nowhere called the Allagash. The Allagash is an area. There's several lakes. There's Eagle Lake and several lakes. They had a sighting there. They went out on their canoe. They built a great big bonfire. This light came over them, and Chuck flashed his flashlight at the craft, and supposedly the thing went right over them, and then they kind of didn't remember anything for years. But it was really funny because they rowed back to the shore, and the fire was almost out. And they built this big blazing bonfire so they could find it. And it was just a couple minutes later. Then they all were having dreams about this thing. It's really a great case to look into. They had dreams. And Jim Wiener, one of the brothers, Jack and Jim Wiener, twin brothers, he was injured in the hospital. And they were bringing around books. And one day they brought around Whitley Strieber's book with the alien on the front of it. And he saw it and he freaked out. And then he had the whole memory come back, and they were interviewed separately, and they all had the memory of being up on the craft and being scanned and, you know, moved their arms and joints moved all over the, you know, things like that. So and they're all their artwork changed, you know, and one of them became a NASA scientist, and he wasn't even good at math and became really good at math afterwards.
Really?
Yeah. So, yeah, it's a fascinating story. Wow. And another one that I personally consider up there is one of the really great UFO encounters out there. So yeah, one to check out for sure. So other stories that you can remember, and you know, I did say we're going into break here in about 7 minutes or so, but are there other stories that you remember at the table besides like Calvin, or were you kind of at the end of was your father slowing down in these cases? No,
he was still going strong. You know, my father was born in 1910 and he died in 1986. So he came and went with Halley's Comet, which is a nice sort of bookend life for an astronomer. And until maybe late 1985, he was vibrant. He was very healthy. He had a very short, fortunately, morbidity period, but he was very sharp and still fascinated by UFOs into 1985.
Wow. And there had been a lot of waves. Do you remember when there were like waves? You know, I'm trying
to remember. Flaps, right?
Flaps, yes. Yeah. So that must have been pretty exciting during those times. And
yeah, you know, the 70s was interesting time. The National Enquirer was all over UFOs. And we had the movie Close Encounters, which was really a bellwether or a milestone, right? Because it really gave a lot of people permission, I think, to talk about the subject more seriously and honestly than before, because most of the Hollywood portrayals of aliens and all that before were evil ray guns and things like that and body snatchers and all that. And, you know, this was a big, you know, tentpole movie that portrayed aliens in a very friendly way, a little bit mysterious, but very friendly. and really focused on, again, the sort of aspects of an experience that are not the actual sighting, but this communication and this obsession of, you know, ongoing communication before, during, and after the sighting. So that really, I think, helped move the needle a lot on the level of and the quality of public discourse.
Right, right. And did you ever personally meet Steven Spielberg?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
You did.
That's both great. During filming of Close Encounters, and then later, you know, I worked on a bunch of movies, and one of the movies was Tintin, which he directed. And I'm in visual effects, and I'm in our studio, and we had name tags with our pictures. And Michael Kahn, who was Steven Spielberg's longtime editor, is just walking down the hallway and glances and sees my name tag and says, Hynek, are you related to J. Allen Hynek? I said, that's my father. And he goes, oh, my gosh, he was the technical advisor on Close Encounters, and Steven loved him. Does Steven know if you're here? And I said, I really don't know if Steven knows a lot about me or my whereabouts. And he said, I'll tell him. So that was a Friday afternoon. And bright and early Monday morning, a PA comes to me and says, Paula, Steven would like to talk to you.
Ah.
So, okay. So I go to the set and I talk with Steven and Kathy Kennedy, his longtime producing partner, who's also the twin sister of Connie Kennedy, who I worked with for years, about UFOs and Close Encounters. And we had a grand old time. And then I said, hey, my brother Joel is in town. Could I come back on the set and bring Joel this afternoon? They said, of course. So we reconvened for another hour or so that afternoon with Joel. And Joel told Steven what I think is a really heartwarming story about how when he won his Oscar for What Dreams May Come and was very nervous on stage, looked down in the audience and in the front row see Steven Spielberg smiling at him. And that really helped sort of ground and center him.
How about that? Wow. Wow. That's great. That Close Encounters of the Third Kind, your father really coined that phrase, Close Encounters.
Yeah.
And was there ever other words? Did he ever have other terms for that or that he used prior to that? Or?
like what he was workshopping the concept. Yeah. I don't know if he had ones before that. I think he'd be gratified to know that people still use that classification and they've added, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, who knows what else.
Yeah.
Cause I, you know, for my father's a scientist. What he wanted to do even before UFOs was sort of take a flashlight to the edges of known science and just push the bubble a little bit further. And to do that with UFOs, he had what I think is the crucial insight that he wasn't studying UFOs, he was studying UFO reports. And part of that meant that he wasn't spending so much time on astrophysical concepts, but actually touchy-feely talking to people, which he was not trained for as an astrophysicist.
Sure.
So there's a whole different sort of branch for him to go down. But when he realized that sort of level of remove that he's dealing with reports, that's when he realized it would be very helpful to come up with a lingua franca, a classification system that people could use around the world to better compare, you know, interstellar apples to apples. And so that seems to have stuck and been useful. He coined other phrases as well. And one of my favorites is high strangeness, which
he's
is one of
that
the
one?
Yeah, oh, high strangeness. I love that, which is a
me too.
And you can you immediately understand what it means, but he had a lot of very interesting turns of phrase and ways to sort of classify this, you know, really bizarre phenomena.
Great. Maybe we'll talk a little bit more about that on the other side of the break. It's time for us to go into it right now. We'll be back in exactly 3 minutes. So hang in there over at KGRA Radio with the commercials, and we'll be right back. All right, Joe, welcome to the show. And I'm excited to hear about your sighting. You have called into my show in the past, but this is something, this is something that's happened since that time, right?
Yeah. So I had called in early in August, and a few days later I had this sighting, coincidentally. I was in Mammoth Lakes, California. Just got done with a backpacking trip, and this is over the Eastern Sierra Nevada mountains, kind of up towards Yosemite.
Yeah.
So it was the last day that we were out there. I decided I was going to do some stargazing because you can see the Milky Way galaxy and everything, and turn off all the lights, went outside, and I noticed immediately this bright green blue star below Saturn. And that was looking out, I would say, probably like southwest, approximately 9:30 p.m. So pretty dark outside, and it was bright. If you're looking at Jupiter or Venus in the night sky right now, it was brighter than that. And it was green, and it was not moving. And I watched it for about a minute, and then it started to move slowly to the left, and then it sped up, and the brightness increased in intensity, and it shot what I would describe as like a small star out of the bottom of it. So it just like shot this little light that just went straight down behind the mountain range. And then it kind of slowed down, and it would start to move left a little bit and then kind of drift to the right. And then it would kind of jut upwards and then drift back down. So it did that, I would say, for, I don't know, 4 to 5 minutes. And at that point, my mom came outside and she was looking at it with me. So she was saw it too. And then I actually went up the stairs of the condo above us. There was no one in there, luckily, but it had kind of drifted below the like horizon, below the tree line. So I had to go up the stairs to look at it. And then I watched it get dimmer to the point where you almost couldn't see it. And then it would get bright again to the point where it was like brighter than Jupiter again. And it would get dimmer again. And did that for, I don't know, I watched it for maybe 10, 15 more minutes. And I just got bored.
You know, it's funny, I talk about that. You probably heard me talk about that. There's a number of people that a friend that I'm visiting with right now, her mother got bored watching this amazing UFO outside after a while.
Yeah,
so you saw this thing take off.
Yeah, no, it's quite interesting. I didn't notice it take off or do anything crazy. I'm not sure if it was getting farther away or just getting, you know, dimmer and dimmer. I couldn't really tell, but it definitely seemed like it was getting farther and farther away.
All right, welcome back. That if you check our YouTube channel tomorrow, there'll be the full interview talking about some other encounters that he had over the years. There we go again, encounters. I'm not sure what type of encounters, but I'm with Paul Hynek, and I'll bring him back in. Paul, so this is pretty exciting. I do want to say this also about that last video. What made me think that encounter that Joe was talking about just now is fascinating. I would have kind of discounted the whole thing until he said this light dropped from the bottom from this object and went down. And that's something you hear about, or I've actually seen online. And, you know, when I see these videos again on YouTube, I don't know what to trust and not to trust, but there are a number of videos on YouTube where something drops, or sometimes multiple things come out of these things.
Yeah, right.
So drones, who knows what the heck they are. I mean, I don't know if a drone can do that. But further on in the conversation, he does talk that he was in a very remote area, and it would be very strange if someone had a drone in that area in particular. But so we have to deal with a lot these days, as you know, Paul, that it's not just like the simple UFOs that are flying around. We have you know, there's the drone issue. That's one. I mean, I had a sighting that I thought for sure was a UFO for a while. I sent it off to a photo analyst, Mark D'Antonio, friend, astronomer. And he said, well, it acts like a drone. It looks like a drone. It must be a drone type of thing. So, but it was doing a couple of weird things. But, you know, you can be deceived by whatever it is. It was very windy that night. You know, the light was really bright and then dark, and it zigzagged all over the place, but it was most likely a drone. That's one thing we have to deal with. Chinese lanterns. There are so many people that think they see UFOs when there's Chinese lanterns. These things weren't around when your father was looking into this topic. But there were some strange encounters. You know, people, I actually really like the ones that are really different. I don't know how you feel about that, but when they're like, they don't sound like anything else. I love those type of encounters.
Well, you know, I do DMT, so no kind of UFO experience is going to throw me for a loop.
Yeah. Well, that's right. That's right. And do you have people like that will approach you now and say, oh, I know your father, who he was or whatever, and let me tell you about what I saw. So
yeah.
Have you heard some good ones?
Well, you know, all of us kids are ports of entry for people who feel compelled to reach out because, you know, my father was a sympathetic person who understood that for a lot of people he's talking to, whether the experience was objectively real or not, felt that it was real and had gone through a very traumatic experience. So he was very patient and understanding, I would say sympathetic, not empathetic, with them. And they felt that. They felt that he was kind of like a safe harbor, that they could bring forth this deep, dark secret that may have, you know, buried for years. And when I first started getting active and speaking about UFOs, et cetera, and conferences and things like that, the first time, I think it was maybe at an Alien Con conference, which is massive, you know, thousands of people. And after I was done on stage, I was walking off stage and 30, 40 people rush up to me from the audience. And I really didn't know what to make of it. And it was because they saw me as a conduit to my father and that here is permission and somebody that they believed would give them a sympathetic ear, that they could talk about it in comfort. And I could see what it must have been like for my father to sort of broadcast, hey, I'm an astrophysicist and I believe you, or I accept what you say. And so we've had a lot of people come up to us, emailing, telephoning, mailing, and in person, really feeling comfortable and also sometimes compelled to share one story or another.
Yeah. I love the stories. That's why I'm recording with people now that listen to the show. There's stories. Some of them have been really, really amazing. So this one, this text I'm putting up here, we already talked about that earlier on, if you didn't catch it. But you think it was around the Socorro case when your father really kind of went over to the other side, so to speak.
Yeah, I would narrow the parameters a little bit. By that point, I think he had already accepted the UFO phenomena as legitimate. We'd been working on it for maybe 14 years or so. But it was the Zamora case that made him feel comfortable with the alien beings aspect, not just an object. So that in particular, Jacques points to as the sort of signal case or the straw that broke the camel's back that made my father much more comfortable talking about such cases. And, right. You know, I think part of it is that I think my father viewed the world in terms of UFOs as having like three main constituencies. One is the military and the government. Another is mainstream science, which is really his, you know, wheelhouse. And then call them UFO believers. And I challenge you to think of three more different entities or groups than military, say astronomers, and UFO fans.
Right.
And I think he felt he had to keep each of these groups mildly displeased. And then he's probably doing about the right balancing act between three groups who want very different things.
Isn't that funny? That's pretty funny. The book that just came out, a re-release of the Hynek UFO report. I'm not sure. Was that the original title of that book in 1977?
Yes.
Okay. And did it also have the line, the subline of the Project Blue Book cover up, was that in there as well at that time?
No, that is a new addition to the cover.
Okay. And so this is being re-released, a book that I have not read that I really would love to read. Did your father actually say that, come out and say there was a lot of cover-ups in Project Blue Book?
Yeah, you know, I don't think it was my father, but I think he liked this phrase that someone once called Project Blue Book, which was the Air Force's official department to study UFO reports, which was really not looking to get at the bottom of things, but really more of a PR exercise to tamp down public hysteria. And they, because, you know, Project Blue Book, as reflected in the TV show of the same name, really wasn't about reverse engineering propulsion systems or getting to the bottom of the phenomena. They just wanted to calm people down and explain every case. And even with that very strong mandate from the top, of the 12,000 or so cases that they officially investigated, they still couldn't explain 5%, which is about the same batting average around the world. And I find that fascinating. So somebody once, and because they would always explain things, and that was the tension between most of the Air Force directors and my father being the scientific consultant, of the Air Force just wanted explanations. They didn't want him to get to the bottom of it. They wanted this professor with his academic gravitas to explain things away. And so someone referred to Project Blue Book as the Society for the Explanation of the Uninvestigated.
Yeah. How about that? And well, do you think that's what the former programs were doing too? Grunge and what was the other one?
Sign.
Yeah. Project Sign.
So I think it sort of shifted. The earliest one was Project Sign, and that was actually more open, and there is the controversial, you know, estimate of the situation from 1948 that purports to be a report that says, yes, this is real and we don't know what to do about it. Project Grudge kind of went back and said, no, nothing to see here, folks, go away. And Project Blue Book was just a little bit better than that. Again, especially after 1953 with the Robertson panel,
right,
and the Air Intelligence Service Squadron, which was, if any, the entity that would go out to crash sites to really find what's going on and what probably in my mind spawned the Men in Black. But at that point, Project Blue Book really was just an awareness and a belief engine, as opposed to a bona fide scientific investigation department.
So at the very end, 1969 or 19, was it 1969?
Well, the actual official date was 1970, but the real practical unwinding was 1969. Yeah.
Was your dad there to the bitter end?
Yeah. Bitter end is a good way to put it. And it was, you know, it was the Condon Committee, and
yeah,
you know, it was the swamp gas case in Michigan in 1966, not my father's, you know, favorite time, where the press ran with a quote of his partially explaining the case of swamp gas. He said it's all swamp gas. Well, that rankled the local congressman, Gerald Ford, who, of course, went on to be president, who pulled strings and said, you know, I'm tired of this. We need, you know, something to happen here. And that indirectly led to the Condon Committee in 1969. You know, the Air Force always wanted to sort of hide under air cover of academic, you know, credibility. So they had this panel of professors, like with the Robertson panel. And that basically put an end to Project Blue Book by saying there's nothing here. But the conclusion of the report doesn't even match the data in the report. The data in the report that was cherry-picked is fairly convincing. But the conclusion of the report, because it was jerry-rigged, doesn't even reflect the strength of the data in their own report. But that was the pretense under which the Air Force decided to disband Project Blue Book. Although, as we know now, with ATIP and others, there's been ongoing admitted investigations of UFOs.
Right. And what do you think about what's going on now? Do you think that this is more serious, or do you think it's partially window dressing and maybe more of the same will happen?
Probably both. You know, at this point, having seen so many Freedom of Information Act requests and heard so many stories and waited with bated breath upon what this or that government agency would do, I really just don't care anymore. You know, you and I, and probably all or most of the people watching, accept the phenomena as real. We don't need the U.S. government to tell us anything that we don't know. And so what they choose to admit and why, and the subterfuge and the disinformation, I've just stopped really caring much about what they do, because I don't think that they are going to, or I'd be surprised if they release information any more compelling than they already have. I don't think it's in their interest. And frankly, if I was in the Pentagon, I don't think I would release information. I think I would hold on to it for military advantage, and also, in my perception as a general, to protect the fabric of national security overall.
My thoughts are, and it's just an opinion, and I've said this before, is that they possibly know a little bit more than we do, but they're probably just as baffled as everyone else.
I don't know. I don't think it's a given that they have reverse engineered crafts for years and have bodies. I don't know. Those are hard secrets to keep. But I think you're right that no matter what they have, they're probably even more baffled than we are, because they see even more stranger things. And look, if the U.S. government had successfully reverse engineered propulsion systems since San Antonio in 1945 and Roswell in 1947 and other cases, you'd think they'd have used it by now. But we don't see that kind of overwhelming military superiority. And it's hard for me to think that a military like the U.S. is going to just sit there and not use something that would just sort of, you know, be game over.
Yeah, I've heard someone claim that fiber optics came from the Roswell crash. That's a good theory.
Yeah, sure.
I don't know.
You know, okay. At least they're commercializing it, but not, you know, using it to pound the Russians and Chinese into submission.
Well, of course, that's what we'd do first thing. That's what we'd want to do, right?
That's what I would do, right? If I'm a general and you tell me, hey, general, we've got anti-gravity, I'm going to use that stuff.
Of course. Yeah. And so that kind of goes against the argument you hear all the time. A lot of people, skeptics are, and I think it's good to be skeptical, but most people will say, on the skeptic side, that, oh, these are military craft, they're, you know, black projects that we don't know about or whatever, anti-gravity, but they always forget about people seeing these things, you know, 50 years ago. And if something was out there 50 years ago, there's no way that it could be under wraps all those years, in my opinion. Yeah,
right. I mean, it's certainly possible, but for the secrets not to come out and for that technology not to be demonstrably used to our national advantage, either way you look at it, it's hard to understand. There are some great cases where the government seems to have swooped in and collected artifacts, saucers, etc. But we just don't see what would seem to be the inevitable consequences of that.
Right, exactly. We talked a little bit about Jacques Vallée before. Here's another question. Was he someone that your dad called to talk over cases? Is that, but I have a follow-up question to that.
Okay, absolutely. I mean, they co-authored a book, and they were close friends. And I think there were few, if any, people with whom my father would confide more. And Jacques would go to Project, you know, Blue Book in Dayton. and pore over the cases and use his artificial intelligence prowess, because he had a PhD in AI from Northwestern, to go over the cases to sort of tease out patterns from the cases. So they talked all the time. Absolutely.
Well, the follow-up question that you sort of answered it, but I was going to ask, was there other people as well as Jacques Vallée that your father, you know, leaned on for opinions?
Yeah. And I'm sure you're familiar with the Invisible College, which is sort of Jacques and my father's resuscitation of a old sort of Renaissance area concept of scientists, you know, confiding in private in sort of a safe room environment about a taboo topic. So, you know, Carl Sagan and others, and Arthur C. Clarke. I have, you know, a letter from Arthur C. Clarke to my father right about the time that he was, that the movie 2001 was going to be released, saying that, Professor Hynek, you know, in public, I you know, dismiss UFOs, but in private, I really respect your approach. And so they had a correspondence going back and forth. And there were a lot of other people who would say that, and astronomers and others who would say, I can't say this publicly, but hey, you know, you go in private.
Wow. Yeah. I just put up this from Arthur C. Clarke. I love this for this quote, two possibilities exist. Either we are alone in the universe or we are not. Both are equally terrifying. I love that one.
Yeah. I hadn't seen that before. I like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's see. We had a comment up here. I was going to, so this right here, I get, this is from over on Facebook. Thank you, Jay. Did he ever have anything to do with Hal Puthoff, Targ and other, the conscious aspect of the phenomenon? Is this kind of new agey these days, or was there ever anything talked about when it comes to consciousness and the phenomenon?
Yeah. And, you know, that gets back to, that's a great question about the extraterrestrial hypothesis kind of lacking. This is the kind of meat on the bones that the ET hypothesis doesn't readily address. There seems to be a deeper, call it psychic or consciousness or other layer to the phenomena that is really the most fascinating. I mean, if you study UFOs as my father did, you know, going around the world and looking at, you know, trace elements in the earth and, you know, examining radar reports and all that. Okay, that's great. But after a while, you get convinced and it's just more the same. And what propelled him and Jacques and you and others is this sort of extra, this sort of bonus round about the phenomena of consciousness. And, you know, are these, you know, I mentioned interdimensional, but I also mentioned in passing the potential manifestations of collective unconscious. And, you know, one of the things that Jacques has pointed out is that if you look at UFO reports, they tend to take on the appearance of the current scientific awareness. So in the 1890s, you had these sort of steampunk type airships floating around with like flaps and things like that, right? Because that's what we understood. Now, you can interpret that in different ways, but it is a part of the phenomena. So the notion of consciousness, and you mentioned, you know, the guy, I think in Allagash, right? You know,
yes,
with a flashlight or this communication or close encounters of the fifth kind, of this ability to apparently summon them to come, is part of the most, I don't want to say elusive, but most compelling aspect of the phenomena, that there is this communication, which is part of consciousness, between experiencers and, say, the aliens on a sometimes a continual basis. So that notion of consciousness and communication is about the most fascinating aspect of all, I think.
Really fat. Yeah. I mean, this is, again, all part of it, or it could be one of the parts. So this email just came into me and I would like to read it to you. It's from a Leonard. He says, thanks to both of you for the interview. I had the privilege of being one of the handful of students taking an astronomy class at the University of Waterloo that attended a presentation by Dr. Hynek around 1969-1970 that ignited an interest in the phenomenon, as well as distrust for the official, quote unquote, drive, both of which I have increased over the years since. Currently working on Channel 5 of his book, I would like to know the thoughts of both you with respect to those scientists that seem to completely disregard, if not discredit, the phenomenon. In contrast to that, these have been those who are advocating that serious science be applied. Perhaps the other hominid species were more advanced ethically and not aggressive and warlike. So I don't know what you have any comments about that comment.
Well, for some reason, it wasn't in Waterloo, but my father gave a presentation in Canada, and he had, you know, slides and, you know, his, call it his stump speech at the ready, but apparently he forgot them in the hotel, so he had nothing to do. And so, you know, being an accomplished professor, you know, you have to go on in any case. And so what he did was he walked up on the dais and to the lectern and said, "Hello, my name is J. Allen Hynek, and I'm here to talk about UFOs. UFOs are a fascinating subject, and now I'll take questions." So, I don't know, that just popped in my head, but
yeah. As and for, how that, did that work?
Yes, it did. It did. Because he could obviously expound for hours and go down very interesting paths based on questions. And he'd heard every question probably in the world until that point. In terms of mainstream science and, you know, perception, like sort of dogmatic refusal of the heresy of things outside that flashlight that my father took to the fringier areas of science, you know, to me, again, I'll draw the parallel to the incident we were talking about at NORAD, where it may not be conspiratorial orders from your superior to dismiss this, but just it's not part of what you're doing. I think for a lot of scientists, UFOs are intriguing. Let's say astronomers, right, where there's roughly, you know, a relation to a UFO phenomenon. But they're very busy. They're maybe looking for tenure as well. They have to publish a new paper. They have to grade the papers of their students. They may be a department chair. They're very busy, and they're going for a grant. And they hear about UFOs, but, okay, that doesn't help them in their career. They're very career-focused, and they have to write a book, and they've got a family and whatever else going on. So to me, it's almost just there's no perhaps connective tissue of conspiracy driving them all to, you know, have like that Roman shield wall against this newcomer. It's just a very prosaic situation of a lot of them being busy and not seeing enough to really intrigue them on a personal level, and they just have other stuff to do. I think that's a lot of what it is in science that keeps new phenomena at bay for some time, just because they're all busy doing what they're already thinking about.
That is a really, really good point. By the way, did your father get tenure?
Oh, yes. He was the chairman of Department of Astronomy at Northwestern for 20 years or so.
It's funny.
But at the same time, Northwestern hated. They absolutely hated my father's UFO work. But fortunately, he had enough standing in the astronomical community by having worked on the proximity fuse in World War II, by leading Operation Moonwatch, you know, placing observatories around the world in the late 50s to track what were then known as artificial satellites, and, you know, his other astronomical work to be a bona fide astronomer. So Northwestern, you know, kind of just put up with his UFO antics.
How about that? I had the pleasure of, we have a couple of questions in chat I'll put up there. I had the pleasure of hanging out with Bryce Zabel and Dave O'Leary out in California, a few weeks ago, maybe a month ago or something. And I was out there where you were, and you were out here where I am. And too bad we didn't meet up. But anyway, what did you, and I think Dave O'Leary is a great guy. I really think he's a real fine guy. But overall, were you okay with how Project Blue Book History Channel's Project Blue Book series went, or do you think it was? Do you think it kind of hurt anything, or do you think it was okay?
Well, and first, let me say for the record that having the super villain from Game of Thrones play your TV father,
Littlefinger,
not super creepy at all. actually, he's a fine guy, and I count as a friend now. You know, my brother Joel and I were consultants on the show Project Blue Book, and I think the show was great. You know, Dave O'Leary, the creator, and Sean Jablonski, the showrunner, Arturo Intarian, the initial, you know, executive, and the cast and the crew were all big, I don't want to say fans, but they accepted the UFO phenomenon and they believed it was important and they wanted to get stories across. The gist of the show, you know, portrays my father and my mother and bases, especially in season one, upon actual reports. Doesn't actually mean that there are actual events, but the show is about authenticity. You take two characters, you understand what makes them tick. And we talked with Aiden and Laura, who played my dad and mom respectively, quite a lot. And you place them in stretched circumstances. And the importance for Joel and I, and we would read pre-production scripts, because as a consultant on a show, you don't control it. You don't dictate what happens. You can influence. And since both Joel and I worked in Hollywood a lot, I asked if we could read the pre-production scripts and go to the set, and they said, sure. So we were able to review each script beforehand and give input, and they did accept a lot of it. And, you know, you got to pick your battles, and it's a function of the relationship that you establish, the trust, and, you know, the quality of the comments that you give. And so our family was very happy that they portrayed our parents in a respectful way, and it's understood. And they even mentioned the beginning of the show, look, click on the website afterwards to learn more about the real report of this case.
That's right.
So I think the show had an interesting premise of starting with actual reports and real people and then taking it a little bit farther. So yeah, I'm very comfortable with the show. And I think, like Close Encounters, it had enough fictional elements to draw more people into the tent as opposed to just an echo chamber of already converted UFO diehards.
Right. I just want to know, did you grow up with all that great mid-century modern decor furniture?
Oh, the production value was fantastic. You know, no,
I love some of the pieces.
Robert Zemeckis is a cinematographer, so it had a very filmic feel. And the sets and the wardrobe are fantastic. You know, the last episode of season one, Laura, my TV mom, is wearing a coat and this turquoise brooch. And I remember looking at that saying, wow, that looks familiar. I forgot that I had given that to Laura before the show started. And that was actually from my mom.
Isn't that amazing? That's awesome. We have someone that actually called in. I guess he remembered the phone number here. We haven't even posted the number yet. We have, let me pull in KGRA Radio on the phone line. So we have Ronald from Minnesota. Is it Minnesota?
Hey, Martin. Happy New Year. Hello to Paul.
Happy New Year.
Very interesting guest and very interesting show. Thank you for your doing a show so early to the holiday and getting right back to work.
Yeah.
Hopefully things will open up and we'll get back to some more conferences this year. But I have a question for both of you about concerning not the craft necessarily, but the aliens that are in the craft. I've talked to religious people, you know, and they all say, oh, they're fallen angels or they're demons and God couldn't create anything else out there. he only created human beings. And it's like, well, that's kind of, you know, kind of selfish, in my opinion, for somebody to think that way. And in my opinion, I think God can create anything, anywhere. I'm saying God in general, you know, for anybody, you know, source or whatever you want to call him. Anyway, the grand creator of everything, I think he could create life of any kind anywhere, okay? I do believe that there is aliens. I don't think they're demons or fallen angels. I think some of them could be. But at the same time, what do you think? And then also, what is their message to us? Why are they visiting?
You can take that, Martin.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Paul. Yeah. I like the observation part, you know, theory or whatever. You know, one of the people that I interviewed for his UFO sighting, he sort of got a message, and he was saying, it gives him chills when people say, you know, that they had telepathy. But he said that this thought came into his mind when he looked up and saw these hominid type things in the window that don't worry, we're just, you know, we're just observing you. And, you know, I would think, you know, we must be interesting to something out there. You know, perhaps that is part of it, you know, observation. Any thoughts, Paul?
I don't presume to know much more than anybody else. I like what you said, Ronald, about how not demons, and how it seems pretty limiting to think that we're the only, to go back to your word, Martin, bipedal creatures around. It's an awful lot of overkill. You know, nature's very efficient, right? And it seems like a lot of sloppy overkill that we're the only life force that we know of, or that God, however you worship a God, would have created a universe so vast, and we're the only amount of life on this tiny, insignificant orb. So that just seems really unlikely to me.
A waste of space, as they say.
Yeah, right. I mean, if you're going to just make life here, you know, make this planet, make about 20,000 others so we could see in the sky and call it a day.
There you go. Good plan. Well, thank you again for a great show, and we'll see you later on in the year, and I'll be watching for all of your work that you put out there. Thank you.
Happy New Year, Ron.
Thank you, Ron. I met Ron, Ronald. He came to Pine Bush, drove all the way out from Minnesota at Pine Bush. I'm sure you've heard of Pine Bush, or the UFO in New York, all the sightings out that way. So the line is open. That number is 855-472-5483. Another question came in email. I don't really like to have questions on email while I'm doing a show, because I'm going to miss them. But why are experiencers so compelled to pursue the issue through life? And I guess you could take that in a few different ways. I don't know. Let me just put it this way. If I was being abducted like people talk about that happened to them, I don't know how I'd even function. You know, it'd be such a part of my life. I don't know how I could go through day-to-day life and be semi-normal. You know, it's any thoughts on that?
Yeah, you know, it goes back to this notion that let's step back from UFOs in particular and just sketch out an experience that you have where you see an entity, and it could be a UFO experience or DMT or a dream, or you're walking down the street and you see an entity, and that entity appears hyper real to you, super intelligent, may possess some kind of communication that they give to you, a warning or a hello or anything. How do you not, what they say, obsess or feel compelled about that? It'd be such a signal event in your life, so atypical. And how do you stop sort of attempting to process something that is so overwhelming in terms of its uniqueness and perceived significance. And I think, you know, we are pattern seeking mammals. So it's natural. It's evolved in us to try to find meaning in that. And perhaps you sense meaning because you feel that you've had a communication, and that communication would be perhaps life changing. Or on the other hand, you don't feel a clear communication, or you feel it was dark and hostile. And now you're seeking for meaning in this event that's unlike anything else that's ever happened. And I, like you said, Martin, I think either way, it's just not something that you say, yeah, that was super cool. I met the alien that day. Hey, what's for dinner?
Yeah. Yeah. And also, I think it's really bizarre that these things supposedly happen repeatedly, and to family members. And, you know, there's thoughts on that, different thoughts of that, you know, the bloodlines or whatever and progress. But I mean, for these people to claim this is happening over and over and over and over again, and then to their daughter and to their, I mean, it's all really something else. Another big, huge question mark.
Yeah. There's a sort of hoarding all the great UFO encounters for themselves and their bloodline. Not fair.
That's not right.
Cut me in on some of that.
Yeah, well, better watch what you wish for. All right. So we have Francisco from New Mexico on the line. Francisco, you are live on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Hello. Welcome. Happy New Year, Paul. Happy New Year, Martin. Thank you for the time. Quick question, I guess. If you were a fly in the wall in the honeycomb, you know, growing up, what would you say is like the more common type of encounters or experiences like you would hear, like, you know, someone all alone in a desert, you know, in the desert by themselves, or someone around the water, that type of thing, like something we don't all hear, you know, in the mainstream, if that makes sense, I guess.
I think the question is, I couldn't hear that well, but the question is, what kind of environment were most cases in?
So, hearing people like being there and just kind of growing up in the home, what comes to mind, like what comes to your mind that like seemed to happen more often, I guess, like if we were in your shoes, what would we have heard, you know, more often than not?
Yeah. So, you know, for me, my younger brother being on sort of the tail end, it was already just accepted that these things happened. And so for me, it might seem to be a very unique event to have like a Travis Walton for dinner, but that was just kind of like Tuesday night. We're so used to it. So I grew up completely accepting the UFO phenomena and so many aspects of it that none of it seemed strange. It was just how life was. So there was very little, to your point, Francisco, that jumps out to me as being unusual or that memorable, because it was like that all the time. It was all sort of science-based. We weren't religious, so it was all science-based with a healthy heaping of UFOs on top. So it all just sort of fit together into an accepted worldview, and it was really came down to sort of this strength and the credibility of the witness, because after a while you hear so many reports of a craft doing this or that, you just sort of accept that crafts can likely do things that we can't. And you're not really that amazed anymore by yet another case of a craft disappearing or going underwater, like you said, Martin. But it really comes down to the fulcrum of examining the witness. So I think I became more interested in watching how my father would talk to the witnesses and thinking about them, because that's the one thing you could really look at. And that kind of human psychology was, I think, even more fascinating than reports of saucers and what they did.
Well,
that's awesome. I appreciate the time. Good evening. Again, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Francisco. Talk to you soon. All right. All right. So we have Sarah on the line from San Rafael, California, where I used to live. Sarah, my friend Sarah, how are you? Welcome to the show. You're live on the air.
Thanks, Martin. Happy New Year, Paul, and Happy New Year, Martin.
Happy New Year.
I just have a question. Thank you. I have a question. I've been watching Ben Hansen's UFO Witness on Travel Channel, and he's always referring to this trove of these Project Blue Book. Is this hidden files or something like that? There's a trove, and there was this old woman there who used to take care of it. Is there such a thing? Do you know anything about that? And she also mentioned that supposedly, I get the impression that she worked in Project Blue Book, and that she mentioned too that we had been under observation for centuries.
Seems like network hype. I don't know. I've heard all sorts. I've had so many times people tell me, hey, I've got 100 secret Blue Book files. I don't know of any secret files. I think, you know, I don't know, but I've heard that a lot. And to me, that seems sort of couched in ratings grabbing TV lingo.
But Paul, on that, don't you think that there were reports that came in that were a little too hot, that they had to be like handled elsewhere?
Yeah, sure. And I think those would have gone to the Air Intelligence Service Squadron, which was tasked with going to any kind of downed ship or aircraft site. And they even had Russian speakers, and their job was to get to any crash site of any kind within 6 hours. So I think they would have been the ones to get what you're calling the really hot cases. So I think they would have either been diverted away from Project Blue Book to begin with, or if they had a brief landing at Project Blue Book, would have been moved away very quickly, such that Project Blue Book might well not have a lot of records like that, which doesn't mean they don't exist. I just don't think there's a whole lot at Project Blue Book, because that really wasn't their job.
Sarah, I think I know what you're talking, who you're talking about. I believe James Fox may have interviewed her at one time. But anyway, we have the lines are full. So thank you very much, Sarah.
Sure. Thank you. One other quick thing. Paul, sure. If you have a formula for age reversal or you have a product, put me at the top of the list for it. Okay, thank you.
So if you're interested in age reversal, you certainly want to listen to Martin's other show. But you can go to intervenimmune.com and learn about the publicly available technique now that we've been using to reverse age.
Yeah. And so I will, about that, I will talk to Paul and set up a time and let everyone know. These are shows that are on the YouTube channel, on the Everything Else show. So they'll be coming. And the way you can find out when those shows are, the easiest way is to subscribe. And it's a free subscription, by the way, to our YouTube channel. And just click the notification button. Someone made a very good point. People might think that there's a charge to subscribe, but it's free. Mm-hmm. Anyway, thank you for that, Sarah. And we have Len calling from Ontario. Len, you are live on the air.
Hi, good evening, and thanks so much for your show. I emailed earlier. I just had the privilege of attending a presentation by Dr. Eilen Hynek at the University of Waterloo. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, fine.
Okay, good, because I'm calling over Wi-Fi. One of the questions that was asked of him at the end of the show was, do you have, with your access to, you know, secure information or much more interesting material than what you've presented us with tonight? And his answer was, yes, I do. Next question, please. And moving on away from that topic, keeping his obligations to security and confidentiality. But I just wanted to ask, what do you think of, we constantly think of the UFO phenomenon in terms of our own understanding of physics and the universe, et cetera. And we look at it from, you know, when the question of travel from that distance comes up, we look at it in terms of what we know, and mm-hmm. say that it's impossible, yada, yada. But I've always believed that a civilization that is advanced enough to visit us, regardless of how they're doing it, would also be advanced in terms of ethical and moral terms, and that they likely don't have the need to colonize and conquer. They don't have the need to go in search of food because they can probably synthesize everything they need and yada yada. That there are many aspects to advancement that come into the picture, and that also includes your reference to what is actually happening. Are these communications, or are these is the phenomena part of something other than, you know, physical travel?
I think you make a really good point that if they're able to come here, and even the word here, it means that they're coming from there, and it might be something even more exotic on that. But yes, let's say they're coming from someplace far away. By whatever means they do that, conventional or, you know, they travel in time and space. If they're able to come here, they're by definition so far advanced from us, and they likely have had their own singularity. So they're able to turn the universe into computational engines and do things we would regard as magic. That yes, I quite agree. They don't need our gold. They don't need our food, our water. I don't believe we're exceptional enough as a species that our concept of non-Borg-like individual love is enough to bring them here. And, you know, along with that, if they were coming here and meant us evil, it's like if you see two dogs interacting and you ask yourself, are they fighting or playing? You know they're playing. When two dogs are fighting, you don't ask that. If aliens come here with that superiority and they have hostile intentions, we would know. Or maybe we wouldn't, because we'd be gone immediately. And they wouldn't really need to colonize us or make us batteries or these various, you know, dystopian views of the aliens. So at least for me, it's comforting to know if we're being visited, which seems likely, they're at best indifferent to us, or at worst indifferent to us, and perhaps, you know, caring.
Yeah, well, Travis Walton's experience seems to indicate that they were caring. But also, I wonder if their lack of disclosure, if you will, has something to do with that they won't interfere, or they won't make a serious attempts to reveal themselves until we're beyond our very aggressive and warlike kind of tendencies.
Do you think we will progress beyond our bellicose nature?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. It seems to be a genetic trait, but and that brings into question the whole question, the topic of evolution. You know, our evolution has its own history, and evolution someplace else may have not only progressed differently, but it may have started completely differently. So,
yes,
so many possibilities.
I have to tell you, you're asking and making some really, really good points, Len, and I've really enjoyed your thoughts and your questions a lot. But unfortunately, we have three other people waiting online and only 5 minutes to get through them. So thank you very much. And I'm going to have to move on to the next caller. You can call in again, though, anytime, Len. Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
All right, we have Ken calling from L.A. Ken, you have a fairly quick question for our guest tonight. Hi, Ken, you're live on the air. Ken, are you there?
Ken, you have a fairly quick question for our guest tonight.
All right, you got to mute your device. Mute your device, please. Ken, you're live on the air.
Yes, I have a question, a hypothetical question. If there was an advanced species living in our oceans, what do you think we would see? And if there was, again, an advanced species living in our ocean, do you think that they would be concerned with our nuclear capabilities and our military? And that's it.
Is the answer yes?
Well, I'm not sure. You know, the first part about if there's an advanced being or civilization underwater, what would we see? Probably whatever they deigned to let us see. And in terms of, you know, there's a lot of reports about visitors concerned about nuclear capabilities. But in the very small report put out by the U.S. government in June, on June 25th, they even mentioned something I find very interesting, that it could be observational bias that accounts for a larger amount of reports of sightings around nuclear installations than other places, because at nuclear bases, we have a lot of observational capability. So again, I don't think that our species is viewed as that exceptional by anybody. I don't know if they care about our nuclear capabilities or our, you know, as Len said, our sort of our bellicose nature, but I think a lot of the reports around nuclear facilities are because we're just able to see things better there.
Oh, very good. I'm sorry, that was a great question, Scott. We have to jump to our next guest, which is Scott. I think, Scott, you're calling from Illinois, I believe. Welcome to the show, Scott. You're live on the air.
Thanks, Martin. I'm a big fan of your show. Listen every episode.
Thank you.
Taking my call. So this is a little bit of a selfish reason for me calling. If I could just quickly explain my experience and then ask if there are any cases similar.
Just keep in mind, we have 2 minutes.
2 minutes. Okay. So I saw during the daytime about 10 years ago, a UFO that was rustic and it had red dots going up and down, and it disappeared. It cloaked from the top down, and literally you could only see sky behind it, and it was completely silent. So I'm wondering, are there any cases of people seeing an actual UFO cloak in front of them like that?
Yeah. I have heard one in the desert that did that in particular. They could, all of a sudden they saw the background of the cliff or rock formation. Just, it was right between them and the rock formation. And all of a sudden there was the rock formation. The thing was gone. I don't know if there's any that come to mind, Paul.
Yeah. And I think that's a fascinating sighting. It kind of reminds me of when you go transition between PowerPoint slides and you have that kind of wipe, right? So that's an interesting one. But I think also it gets hard to distinguish between if you're seeing something and it cloaks itself, or it just moves so fast that you can't even see it.
Yeah.
And it would produce the same result, that you see it and now it's gone.
That's right. I've heard a lot of that. Unfortunately, we're out of time. So, Paul, I can't wait to have you on the Everything Else show to talk about why you're younger now than you used to be. But thank you so much. It's always a lot of fun talking to you. All right. You take care.
All right.
Bye-bye. All right. Bye. All right, everyone. So we'll be back next week with Christina Gomez. And thank you all for listening and watching the show tonight. And remember to keep your eyes to the sky.